This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Jamie Curcio.
Hey,
he
doing?
Is a writer, musician, and artist, and he has a new book out, Narratives, Machines, Modern Myth, Revolution, and Propaganda. Jamie, it's great talking to you.
Yeah, it's good to talk to all of you.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Sam Kevorkian, and J.J. Michael.
Nice to have me again.
Thanks for inviting me on.
JG, you told me you've been following Jamie for quite some time. How did you first become aware of his work? You've been corresponding for a while as well.
Yeah, I believe it started when Jamie was working with Joseph Matheny. With Grey Lodge, which, you know, a cult art collective.
Yeah. Joe and I met up actually through New Falcon Press, who New Falcon used to publish Aleister Crowley, Robert Anton Wilson. They had some connections with Israel Regardi. My first book was published with them, and I met Joe through them, and we started working together that way, involved in ARGs. So it was Grey Lodge was the first thing that you kind of encountered.
Yeah, cool. Definitely.
Did you encounter Alterati at all?
Yes, I listened to Alterati, the podcast.
Podcast, and it was a web magazine. This was back in like 2007. It's kind of a interesting segue to Narrative Machines because that was kind of what ultimately became one of the chapters in Narrative Machines started out as an article that I wrote, back in like 2007 on Alterati counterculture and sort of how it kind of always feeds off of itself when it's within a sort of capitalist context. So, that's a full circle.
So, Narrative Machines, it's a philosophical book primarily. It touches on a lot of different themes from different cultural movements to identity politics. What is the meaning of these crucial philosophical questions? I think a good way to start is with Baudrillard and his concept of the simulation. And I haven't read his books, but I know the story with him is he was asked to go be a war reporter for the first Gulf War. And his response is like, why bother when I can just watch it on TV? And you kind of ponder that question, like, is this whole existence the simulation? And you also reference that film, They Live.
I think Simulacra and Simulation, at least off the top of my head, I think it came before. I think he wrote that in the 80s. But the sort of central idea is that, we live in this sort of kind of called hyper-reality, which is, our perception of each other is mediated not by our actual experience necessarily, but by our sort of media. And I don't mean just mass media. I mean, obviously nowadays, like he wasn't writing about social media in the 80s, but a lot of his writing almost feels fresher in some ways in the context of social media and kind of the world we're sort of entering now.
Joked in your book that in the future, healthcare funding will be raised through
crowdfunding. Yeah. Will you be popular and relatable enough to successfully crowdfund your healthcare? Which is relevant, obviously, right now. People are really pretty concerned about that. But I mean, it's something I've seen, for the last couple of years. I'm sure all of us have in our feeds of someone like, whether it's like I broke my leg or whether it's like I have cancer or all these other things, and it's like petitioning your friends to like give handouts. It's a very strange thing when you think about it.
Is your book primarily a philosophical critique of society as it is in different political movements, or do you put forth your own ideology?
I mean, I think it kind of, it's a critique of ideology, but you can't critique ideology without at least kind of covertly presenting an ideology, and it's kind of self-aware of that. I think that's some of the irony that exists throughout the book and also in the art that I incorporate it and stuff is sort of giving the sense of like, like Adbusters, but being aware of itself as, you know, the fact that you're still selling a product. You know, if you're selling an idea, you're still selling a product. I think the main objective of the book, though, isn't to create like a philosophical critique of society so much. I mean, it's almost literature in a way, where the main thrust of it is that the myths that we use to mediate between each other, that we use to determine ourselves, what, you know, myths, are kind of central in how we form reality for ourselves. I mean, of course, at the same time, you punch someone in the face, it's like, that's a thing that happened in the real world. And like, no matter how many different ways you narrativize it, you know, it's a thing that happened. And so part of it is also kind of wrestling with that, because a lot of postmodernists were, in my opinion, misunderstood, although some of them kind of went overboard with it anyways, in terms of thinking like, oh, there's no real reality. Anything is whatever you want it to be. That's pretty easy to disprove. That's not quite what most of them were trying to say. It certainly isn't how I interpret Baudrillard.
What is your definition of postmodernism? Because that's a word that gets put out a lot.
Yeah,
and it is pretty nebulous. Hard to define. I guess if I was forced to define it, I would say modernism is based more on the progress of progress, and that we're constantly evolving. And postmodernism is sort of a contemplating on like where we are now, and how would you basically define it?
The way I would put it is that both modernism and structuralism kind of try to understand the world through creating a center, you know, through creating like a sort of structure that you can create that center in and say everything relates to that center point, you know. You know, it's like the idea of Foucault's pendulum. You can hang it anywhere. Post-structuralism is saying there is no center anywhere. There's no, like, everything is relative. And that's the kind of problem that most people have with postmodernism. I'm kind of blending it with post-structuralism, is that, you know, everything is relative.
Oh, are you talking about deconstructionalism?
Right. Yeah, well, this is what I'm saying, is that it is somewhat vague. I mean, you can say postmodernism and be talking about postmodernist art, which borrows from ideas in postmodernism and literature, but they aren't necessarily the same thing. So I try to be a little bit more clear about that in the book, but it is kind of nebulous. You're sort of talking about it loosely, you know, what exactly we mean. It basically is skepticism. I mean, Lyotard, who's another philosopher who's written about this, defines it as skepticism towards all meta-narratives, which basically just means that you're skeptical towards any ultimate truth, basically. There is no ultimate truth beyond what, you know, power, what's Foucault, power, you know, determines what truth is, not something in itself.
And you talk about the debate between Hobbes and Rousseau, and Hobbes's view was that the natural state of man is misery, and that he needs institutions to better himself. And Rousseau's belief was that man is better off just living in his natural state, and that these institutions and civilization create problems. Do you just discuss it in a debate, or do you have a particular side?
Well, I mostly use that. I do bring it up a couple times, but I'm mostly using it to sort of simplify a debate that's been going on for a long time about quote-unquote human nature and whether we're inherently good or quote-unquote bad. You know, and the kind of flip side of that is usually when you think that human nature is bad, you need the state to keep you in line. Whereas if human nature with Rousseau is, you know, is good, you don't need the state. The state's like, you know, the bad big brother that's keeping you stuck in this box when you could just go back to your true nature, you know. And so that's kind of a debate that's been going on, I mean, at least since like what, the 1800s, probably before. I mean, obviously with Hobbes before, but the debate really didn't kind of springboard until later.
J.G. Michaels, do you have an opinion on that debate?
On the, what was that, Robert?
The debate between Hobbes and Rousseau about whether institutions create problems and that humans are better off in their natural state, or that human nature is inherently flawed and we need institutions to better ourselves.
I actually, when I was younger, I dabbled in sort of the anarcho-primitivist circles, John Zerzan, and it's weird because I've moved away from that as I've gotten older. I think there's a lot of reification errors that happen with primitivist circles that think we just need to go back to, you know, this mythical natural state.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what you think of that, Jamie, but if you could comment on it.
I completely agree with that. I'm trying to remember. There's a novel that's like basically, I mean, it's essentially like a parable about like it's like a super intelligent gorilla that like teaches people. Do you know what I'm talking about here? I can't remember the name of it.
It was a book by the author was Daniel Quinn. Ishmael.
Yeah. So this was like one example of that sort of idea of like, you know, if you just could get back in touch with, you know, the noble savage, you know, in our hearts, you know, everything would be all right. Obviously, I'm a little skeptical about that. At the same time, I mean, it's a complicated issue with this, you know, with the state. And what's one of the things I wrestle with in the book, you know, is what the role the state plays in our day-to-day lives, as well as, you know, what role should it play? This book is specifically about aesthetic theory. It's written, because I'm an artist, it's specifically written for like how can artists affect the world politically, but not political art, but still whenever you enter the social sphere, you still have repercussions that are political. So it's like, you know, I try to be careful not to be like, this is a book about politics, because it's not, you know, but because it's a book about affecting the world and engaging with the world socially as an artist, politics invariably come up. So anyways, and part of that wrestling is the question of, yeah, like, how do we feel about the state? It's pretty easy to sort of dismiss it at first, but then the more you look at it, the more problematic that is. I mean, one of the examples I give, which is kind of borrowed from a book called Black Earth, as an example, is, you know, that a lot of the sort of atrocities that happened in World War II happened outside in stateless zones, happened outside the, you know, and the state does, like, you know, even bureaucracy, as much as we hate it, does sometimes still serve a social function that may not be entirely detrimental, which I know my 19-year-old self is, you know, dying that I am saying that, but here we are.
When you work on art, are you trying to get a specific message across, like a social commentary, or does it more come through the art itself and you let the art express itself?
I kind of agree with J.R. Tolkien on this, in the sense that, like, you know, so his book is seen as a parable in a lot of ways of like World War One or World War Two, and he was kind of repeatedly adamant, like, no, this is not the case. Like, I mean, sure, my life experience has affected me, but, you know, it's written for the story. And usually, when I'm writing fiction, anyways, or when I'm, you know, working on an illustrated novel or something that's, you know, more kind of artistic and less strictly philosophical. You know, I try to be true to the intents of that project more than like, you know, here's the message I'm trying to convey. But of course there are still, I mean, you still are trying to convey messages, you know, within fiction. I think that's part of why we do it. It's the whole, you know, lie that tells the truth. Right. So that's, you know, part of my motivation is still communicating with people. Certainly it's just not necessarily to be like, here is the right way to live, because, you know, fuck do I know that, right?
You even ask, does aesthetics pose as an ethic? Can you explain what you mean by that?
Oh, that's a tricky one. You know, I spend several chapters in the book kind of really hashing it out. But I guess, you know, one way to look at it is look back at the previous election that just happened. You know, how much did people's votes, were they determined by, I like how that person looks or how they sound or how I relate to this, you know, and of course, all of that's constructed. You know, we don't know, you know, Hillary Clinton, we don't know, you know, these people, these constructs, right? And of course, most people don't think of politics in that aesthetic sense, but it still is. It's, you know, what appeals to you and what doesn't appeal to you. Why doesn't it appeal to you on an innate level? Like when, you know, if you, for instance, hate people who wear NASCAR hats, why do you hate when you see that? Like, you're already predisposed to feel a certain way about it, and that's an aesthetic reaction. And our ethics oftentimes kind of written on top of that. I don't like that person, therefore they're bad. Whereas that first, you know, sort of judgment come from. Usually it's silent. Usually we aren't as conscious of it, but it's still there.
Yeah, and I think aesthetics do affect political movements, because if a political movement creates a really appealing aesthetic and culture, which can also be not just art, music, fashion, architecture, that can really draw people to that movement. Or maybe someone sees a movement and they have a revulsion towards a specific aesthetic, and they want nothing to do with that, either a political group or a cultural group.
Sure. And of course, aesthetics can also be used to sell things that would otherwise be abhorrent to people ethically. I mean, I think a lot of people were brought into the alt-right thing, you know, at least gradually through a sort of aesthetic that appealed to them, a sort of counterculture. Now, you know, this is the hip thing now, without necessarily recognizing what they're signing on for in some cases. So, yeah.
Are you talking about the whole meme culture and like the comedy angle, like the Pepe the Frog memes? You're talking more about visual aesthetics. I think you even talk about things like vaporwave.
Yeah, I do. Vaporwave, I bring in more in terms of retrofuturism, which we can talk about, but that's a separate kind of thing. But I'm talking about, I mean, you know, I guess one example we could give is like the whole, you know, Milo thing, and how did, you know, Milo sort of appeal to these people? It was purely an aesthetic thing. I mean, his, you know, politics are sculpted around this sort of, you know, rebellious aesthetic that appeals to a certain segment of people these days. Or did, I don't know.
Jamie is hitting on a real strong point here with regards to the way, I think one of the lines that really struck me in Narrative Machines was how, I think you said that aesthetics are often flattened into mm-hmm. ethics. You know, I think yeah. those were your exact words. And I think that's a really insightful comment on your part. And how the alt-right has become very like a rebellious sort of countercultural thing. I think anyone that looked at it for some amount of time can see that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, for a little while, I don't really pay much attention to it anymore, but there was a while before the election, especially where I was sort of, I'd say it like, you know, it's more like opposition research of a sort, but, you know, there's a certain fascination too, because a lot of it was like a warped mirror of a lot of the counterculture stuff that I came up in like 2005 to 2007, but there wasn't this whole, you know, sort of nativist or like nationalist, none of that stuff was part of it. This was more like Discordian, Robert Anton Wilson, you know, etc. But it still immanentized the Eschaton and all this stuff that's coming up again, but in this sort of funhouse mirror sort of way, which we've talked about online a little bit, you know, how sort of strange that well, is.
In your book, you talk about like bands like Death in June and Leibach that kind of flirt with fascist imagery. Was that the comparison you were making?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the other ways I talk about, you know, the aesthetics versus ethics thing. Is Leibach is a great example. There's a book called Interrogation Machines. I think it's by Alexei Monroe. Anyways, it's looks at Leibach and similar art movements that... I mean, at least in his formulation, you know, they're not so much parroting fascism as they're using the same aesthetics that are have been effective for fascists to counterfactual fascist goals. But of course, that can get muddled for people. And you know, I saw this kind of growing up in the industrial scene, and you know, being involved in music in that scene for a while and stuff is, you know, you see people who sort of don't know what it's all about, and they come in, and you know, pretty soon, like they're going from, you know, fashy fashion to like, this is interesting. And it's like, oh no, I know where this is going. Get away fast. I think like, you know, pretty soon those, you know, the people, you know, are wearing like combat boots, and then the next stage is they're wearing, you know, SS uniforms, and the next stage is, hey, Mein Kampf, there's some good ideas in here. It's like, oh, okay, bye.
So are you in support of the fascist ideas, or
no.
Are you – okay. So
No. Okay. No, that's kind of the whole point, you know, is – I mean, that's the point of it being potentially effective and also very dangerous to play these things. I mean, the example I bring in several times is David Bowie, and I think his – see, I don't know if – how many people know about this nowadays, but like in the 70s, you know, people considered that he was, or thought that he was flirting with fascism. There was this whole to-do about him supposedly giving like a Sieg Heil. And of course, his whole Thin White Duke era, like, you know, he was playing with his ideas, but he was doing it in a purely aesthetic way. He wasn't politically minded really at all. He was also on a lot of cocaine, but that's a whole other story at the time. So it's more, I'm more thinking about it in sort of the way that Bowie was playing with it than like, yeah, no, I'm definitely not being like, oh, like we should consider nationalism because those uniforms look really snazzy.
One theory I've heard put out is during the 80s, you had the kind of conservative Margaret Thatcher establishment in the UK that held up Winston Churchill as a hero. So the irony is you had this sort of counterculture movements in England, whether it was a punk or new wave, that flirted with a fascist imagery as a way to kind of give the middle finger to the Thatcher establishment.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and punk was definitely a thing with that in the 80s and as well. I think that's completely accurate.
I don't think Milo is really a fascist. He's kind of a conservative libertarian, but
he likes whatever helps his pocketbook, honestly.
Yeah, he's kind of a shock artist. He gets off at doing these publicity stunts that will bring him attention.
Yeah.
He's pretty much was considered alt-light. He's the face of the alt-light.
This is another thing I talk about a bit in terms of counterculture, is the sort of endless fragmentation, and there's a sort of irony here, because I mean, it's especially popular in countercultures, but it almost doesn't matter what your political affiliations are. Like, you know, the more you sort of double down on your sort of collective identity and, some people say, oh, I'm alt-right. And then there's this other faction of people who believe this thing that we don't believe in, and then you fracture again, and then you fracture again. it's not necessarily a good way to get things done, although I suppose in terms of art movements, that's a whole other story. It might be a good way to get things done.
What I wanted to chime in on is what I really liked about Narrative Machines was it you really honestly tried to grapple with a lot of the ideas of the of writers you disagree with. I know we've talked privately a lot about Nick Land, and I know you've devoted portions of the book to Alexander Dugin.
Yep.
I was wondering if you could just talk about grappling with these authors who you disagree with.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's not like it's... maybe it's because I have a background in philosophy, but I don't see, like, playing with someone's ideas doesn't necessarily mean you advocate them. And in Dugin's case, I just find... I bring him into the book and sort of critique him partially because he does this really bizarre inversion. I don't know how people are familiar with Alexander Dugin. I don't know if I want to familiarize them with him more. So there is that. But essentially, he's like very critical of the West, what he calls Atlanticism, and he's very critical of postmodernism. And yet he, almost without like any exception, uses postmodernist theory as his method of sort of attacking these things. And so I'm just trying to turn the tables around, really. and I think there's interesting ideas to be had in some of Nick Land's stuff too. Although I was with him, I was just more taken by his own biography. At least according to the reports I've read online, you know, he kind of started out as sort of philosopher pushing the edges of things, and then he started taking way too much speed, and then he started taking way too much speed on that, on top of that, and pretty soon he was talking to the amphetamine god and everything went downhill. And somehow he came out of at the end of it like, hello, I'm maybe a racist, I don't know.
you have all these new political movements that are emerging, and some of them not so new, that are, based on past movements, whether it's the Dark Enlightenment, anarchist, communist, the alt-right, what J.G. Michael was talking about, the anarcho-primitivist, all these different movements that are countercultures. And I think they're kind of reacting. They just see like the mainstream culture as artificial. And this all kind of goes back to the simulation. So in a sense, since people see, you get these people, they see mainstream society as fake, so they kind of LARP through these countercultures. Mm-hmm. But do you see those countercultures and political dissident movements as also forms of the simulation?
Yes, completely. And I think that's a good point. And I think one of the things that I would add to it is that this idea of the mainstream culture is all that there really is. I mean, of course, there are, like, you know, massive budgets thrown into Hollywood movies, and so they have a larger pull than whatever. But, like, there is no real... I mean, this isn't a day and age now where there's three network stations, you know? There is no... Everything is a counterculture, in a sense. There is no mainstream in that regard. Like, in terms of the media, it's constantly fracturing, you know? I mean, in sort of less cultural sense, it's like try to find a show these days. I'm like hunting around on Netflix. Okay, maybe it's on Hulu. Maybe it's in this thing. Everything is in different places because nothing has been unified, which is perfectly postmodern.
You do touch on retro futurism and mm-hmm. primarily vaporwave, but I think what's interesting about retro futurism is we basically have... the kind of reactionary yearning for the past, for like an idealized past, and then there's a kind of the present and the future as a direction we're heading in. Basically, retrofuturism is how the past envisioned the future. So you have vaporwave and cyberpunk, which are kind of based on they're kind of tied to the 80s, and then there's a whole bunch of other subgenres like steampunk and decopunk. About retrofuturism. As an artist, I'm just sort of visually attracted to it and fascinated by it. But I think what really draws me to it is it's because it's not something that has been implemented. It's something that could have been, but it's something that doesn't exist. And I guess, it would be fascinating if it did exist.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's... the thing about it that sort of unites all forms of retrofuturism for me is that it's all an attempt to sort of reinterpret the past as the future. I mean, you know, vaporwave is just one example I give because it's kind of silly, and yet, you know, people can Google it and look it up.
Did you make that vaporwave on your Tumblr, or you just posted it?
I mean, I've dabbled, but mostly I just, you know, it's just something I encountered and kind of delved into just enough to use as an example, because it's really one of many, and it's something that's like synthwave, vaporwave, all that stuff has been sort of penetrating into other media. I mean, Stranger Things, which is like a pretty big show on Netflix, soundtrack for that is like straight up synthwave, and the whole show has a sort of, you know, it's all based on like not only nostalgia, but it's creating a fiction based around, you know, a vision of the past that didn't actually happen, at least not in the sort of aestheticized way that it's been pictured. And I mean, actually, I would say, with mentioning Dugin, like at least my interpretation of his politics seems to sort of be very retrofuturist. He has this idea of a sort of mythic occult, you know, sort of traditionalist past that he wants to reify in the future. God knows how or why, but that's what I'm
saying. Well, he's into Gnosticism, so I guess it's different than I. Crowleyan occultism.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's very confusing with him, though, because there are the things he's written where he like ties in chaos magic and a lot of other things in ways that, I mean, it's almost creative in the sense that like it's like so out of left field in terms of the initial intentions. And I really like, you know, I do like the idea of taking ideas and sort of repurposing them to purposes that they hadn't been, you know, initially intended, although it doesn't mean I agree with his use of them, but that's, yeah.
I haven't seen Stranger Things yet, but it's a horror science fiction series with the kind of 80s theme. Have you watched it, and what was your general take on it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I didn't take it to be especially deep, really, at least my first. I've only watched it once, and sometimes I get a better kind of sense of things on a second or third viewing, but you know, it didn't strike me as particularly deep, but and aesthetically it was really solid because it really kind of created this world sound, you know, aesthetic that all of us can feel. Anyone who's alive in the 80s can kind of feel a sort of connection to, and yet at the same time it's not an 80s that any of us actually lived in, you know. And I think it was cool. They got, like, you know, Winona Ryder in it and whatnot, which also helped give that sense of recollection.
I was actually talking to this new retrowave artist, he performed back in the 80s, but he was saying a lot of younger fans of the genre, they didn't live through the 80s, so it's kind of they have this kind of a vision of it, not so much as it is, but more of this kind of a retro-futuristic vision of the kind of aesthetics of, like, the neon-covered cities and, like, flying DeLoreans.
That's something else. I mean, that was actually my first impression when a friend of mine shared a Vaporwave, you know, remix with to me. I was like, the first thought I was like, this person who made this probably wasn't even like, at least like sentient in the 90s, you know, or the 80s, depending on the style. Like, you know, like, so it's their vision, you know, it's like almost like their vision of a time that came before they actually remember. So yeah, I found that interesting.
Well, cyberpunk is also based on that, but cyberpunk is, it's more dystopian than Vaporwave, but it's still something people are kind of drawn to, the visual aesthetics of that.
Isn't it funny, though, that with cyberpunk was sort of, you know, one of the main, I don't know, kind of cultural currents for the counterculture, which was originally sort of around the internet. You know, the internet was a lot of sort of countercultural space for a while.
J.G. Michaels, you were telling me Nick Land wrote a cyberpunk-themed science fiction novel.
Yeah, yeah. Nick Land, I think, has interested Jamie and I both to a large extent, because he does combine the cyberpunk and these retro aesthetics with another area of interest I have is the horror genre and the aesthetics of horror. I don't know if Jamie could talk about that and his interest in that as it relates to philosophy.
I mean, honestly, the essay that you wrote on it for Modern Mythology, I thought was pretty solid. You know, my interest in that is kind of more through Ligotti, as a lens that I approached the writer Thomas Ligotti. You know, his short stories and his one kind of book of philosophy out, Conspiracy Against the Human Race, which is like pretty much straight up nihilism.
I was just going to say one of the ideas that I see in Narrative Machines that relates to Ligotti, that trend in horror, is the Ligotti is this guy that's obsessed with the idea of puppets, or the idea that we are not who we are. We're controlled by forces outside of our control. And one of the ideas I noticed in Narrative Machines is the idea that the things we believe are, we think that the things we believe, we believe them because we want to, or it's our personal aesthetic. In a lot of ways, we're being led by ideology rather than creating ideology, if that makes sense. Yeah, I see that as relating to Ligotti.
That's actually also, I mean, it's actually also in Jung. He says something along the ideas of ideas have people, not the other way around. And I think that's, you know, I mean, it sounds pretty eerie, and it's very Ligotti-like, you know, the ideas that you know, the ideas that engage us, or the things that make us, you know, fall in love or kill someone or whatever, like, you know, we feel like they come from within us, but if you really kind of trace it, it's like it comes from without, and then you can get into some really weird veins of, like, paranoid horror, you know, if you follow that line of thought. I mean, I think one of the nice things about fiction and myth is we can engage with these things without necessarily believing them entirely. But
do you talk about the other retro-futurist subgenres like steampunk and decopunk?
Not too much, because a lot of these things I bring in more as an example to make an overall point, rather than to sort of, you know, like, you know, you could dedicate a book to, you know, how Vaporwave. You could dedicate a book to, you know, anything like that, where you're actually trying to look at.
Well, there's,
you know,
a documentary on Vaporwave.
Yeah, I believe it. It's been an interesting little phenomenon.
Retrofuturism influence your artwork?
I think, well, there's an illustrated novel I'm working on right now called Tales from When I Had a Face, which is, I'd say, in a way influenced by some of the kind of underlying ideas of retrofuturism, although I don't know if anyone would recognize it that way, because it's, you know, it's about this girl who's raised by her grandmother, who's a shaman, and kind of the conflict between living in the modern world and living and being pulled into the sort of world of the tradition and culture that her grandmother is trying to sort of indoctrinate her into. And I'm not trying to make it good or bad. It's kind of both are good, both are bad. But they make different demands on her. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of that's a sort of retrofuturism. So I guess in that way it has, but I haven't, like, spent a lot of time, like, trying to make retrofuturist art or anything. That's not usually how I go at projects. It's usually the other way around. Usually an idea kind of grabs hold of me and I keep trying to stop working on it and it won't let me. And that's the one that I'm like, okay, well, I have to do this, you know, because I have no choice. Kind of drags me along.
Do you get into surrealism in your book? I think you touch on that briefly. And is surrealism an influence on your work?
Yeah, some of the ideas behind surrealism. I think I talk about that mostly in the chapter on the sacred, because there was a real desire within most of the surrealists anyways, and Breton talks about this, of trying to reconnect with the sort of primal source, which they, you know, kind of call the sacred. And you know, my premise is that we lack that. It's not that, because people usually think of myths as being something that's dead and in the past, Zeus or whatever. But, you know, of course, we have myths. It's just any sort of collective story that creates, it kind of has its own life. But what we don't have is necessarily the sense of the sacred. But it's what the sacred is very complicated. So that's why it takes like a chapter and a half to really even start to kind of cut off the layers of, you know, that are sort of occluding it from our vision.
You did write about Yukio Mishima's Confessions of a Mask. What are your thoughts on that work?
Oh, boy. Yeah, Mishima is someone I've been reading for, I don't know, a couple years. My wife introduced me to him. So another of the three books I'm working on, or I guess it's two books now, working on, is called Masks, Bowie, and Artists of Artifice. And, of course, Bowie is one of them. I'm also going to be looking at Mishima a bit. So he was a Japanese writer who, Confessions of the Mask was kind of semi-autobiographical, you know, in the sense that like it was definitely his own living situation, the like overly protective, controlling grandmother, his sort of doting mother who was still at a distance, his aggressive father, and his own obsession with being like Saint Sebastian and shot through with arrows, and his sort of first erotic encounter with the idea of dying, which comes full circle when he ultimately committed seppuku. That's how he died, you know, much later in his life. So the idea of the mask, I borrow pretty heavily from that book in particular, for that, or going to, for that anthology.
Well, you touch on the thing about the mask. What is your interpretation of the symbolism of the mask?
It can be taken from many different angles. I mean, I think it plays a pretty strong role in any society because it's the face that people see it, that people see you as, you know. But I think in sort of more traditional societies, it can be even stronger and harder to break out of that social role that you're written into. So that's one way of looking at it, is as the sort of, you know, the face that everyone else sees you as, whether you're trapped in that or not. But I mean, of course, there's other ways of looking at the mask as a metaphor. It's used in a variety of shamanic ceremonies and, you know, whatnot. And it's not, that's more about personifying, a lot of times it's about personifying, you know, demons or god forms or whatever, becoming the thing that you're, you know. So that's not wearing your mask, but it still is a mask.
I guess a little bit back to our previous topic. If you've seen the film Mishima, Life in Four Chapters by Schrader, that's like a really retro-futurist kind of vaporwave film.
I hadn't thought of it that way, but I could see that. Yeah, that was really good. Because, you know, it actually is based around four of Mishima's stories, but at the same time, it tells the story of his life, and that's very much like Mishima. You can't really read most of his stories. There's a few exceptions, but most of his stories, you can't really read them without starting to get a real sense of his psychology. And part of the appeal is how, like, wrong it is. There's something not right about him, you know, and that's kind of, but we find that strangely appealing. There's one book called The Sailor Who Fell from Grace for the Sea, which is one of the first Mishima books I read after Confessions of a Mask. And I remember I read the whole book cover to cover, and I looked up at my spouse, and I was just like, he wasn't okay in the head, was he? You know, like, you read that book, and like, yeah, it's hard to get away. So he is with, like, all the fiction he creates is, or most of it is very much in him, and I think that got personified in the film as well. And I think it's, if anyone wants to get a sense of Misha, I would definitely recommend that they watch it, even though some of it isn't, like, you know, historically accurate, but that's not really the intent. It's more, you know, to create an artwork that tells you more about the character of the artist.
You have an interest in Aleister Crowley. The primary interest, the primary interest with Crowley is he's either seen as this kind of, there's the interest in the occult, or people view him as just this kind of the shock artist of his time. Do you view him as a serious philosopher? And do you think he put out some serious philosophical ideas? I saw some website. It was a kind of joke website, like Aleister Crowley for President. But it actually put out a political platform that, like, documented his political and ideological views, if you're familiar with that.
Well, I see, serious is the word that gets us into trouble, because I wouldn't call him a serious philosopher, but I do think he has ideas that are worth becoming familiar with. But, I mean, most of those are the ones that are the most kind of humorous and self-deprecating. And, I mean, I think someone was just, like, wanted to get something useful out of Crowley, I would start them with the Book of Lies and the Book of Toth, the tarot deck that he made, and then have him stop there. You know, but I see him. I mean, I think you can look at him as a trickster. You can look at him as an artist. You could look at him, you know, as a complete, you know, charlatan. I think all those things are accurate in different ways. Most of his ideas were kind of borrowed, if you want to call it that, or stolen from other sources, and usually kind of mixed together. But in the process of mixing them together, he created some interesting things. And that's, I mean, that's something I definitely talk about in Narrative Machines, and that's been an influence on me, is, you know, the idea of, you know, originality is somewhat overrated in the sense of a truly original idea. It's more, you know, what are you taking from your influences and what are you doing with it? What are you adding to it? How are you changing it? How are you reinterpreting it or using it to a purpose that it wasn't originally intended for? And I think, yeah, probably a little bit of that was sort of inspired by Crowley early on. He was much more of an influence for me when I was younger, you know, when I was, like, in college and reading Crowley and Nietzsche all the time, and, you know, took myself way too seriously. Speaking of serious.
What are your thoughts on the whole kind of a philosophy of aristocratic individualism, which comes from Nietzsche, but also Crowley relates to that as well, where you're kind of, it's not a libertarian or anarchist individualism, but being kind of an individualist, but having your own kind of a utopian vision of the world and wanting to implement that, if you're familiar with that philosophical concept?
Yeah, I am. I mean, I think that's one reading of Nietzsche. Of course, there's many different Nietzsches, but although most of them aren't collectivists, so in that sense, he is pretty strong individualist, but I think that's also part of what got him into trouble. I haven't been, I mean, personally, talking about my personal sense, my personal feelings, I'm not, like, super crazy about individualism, let alone the aristocracy, or any sort of aristocratic sort of, you know, elitism of, you know, I don't know.
I think individualism and aristocracy are two different things. Like, you could have an aristocracy within a collectivist system.
Yeah, no, that's certainly true.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, I mean, I know it's simplifying in all kinds of ways, but you know, people are always talking about lone wolves, but when you really truly have a lone wolf, they die generally.
That's, you know,
we depend on each other a lot of ways.
Also, individualism leans more towards egalitarianism, which is more anti-aristocracy, because, like, if you have more of a collectivist system, naturally you will have some type of caste system form, because people, like, begin to realize that different people are good at different things, while with an individualist system like we have right now with capitalism, it's like everybody's trying to get to the top, everybody's trying to be a captain of industry. Everybody's trying to be the next Bill Gates, and becomes like everybody's just stepping over each other's toes, and it doesn't lead to like a type of cohesive society that you would have under a more collectivist system.
It's complicated. On the one hand, if people all, specialize, if they're organized, that specialization can create a greater result. I mean, that's basically what civilization has been, right? Is the ability to specialize because you don't have to do everything yourself. But then, of course, then we then lose the capacity to do a lot of things for ourselves. So that's always been a trade-off. And where do we find the middle ground on that? I think it's kind of a constant war within ourselves or with each other to try to find our place.
You did write about the Beatnik writers. What is your opinion of the novel The Wild Boys by William S. Burroughs?
Yeah, I've read a bunch of Burroughs. I haven't read that one. I've read The City of Red Night. I've read Naked Lunch. I've read Junkie. But I haven't read that one. So I can't speak to it too much.
I feel like Burroughs is another literary figure that would fit in very well with the concept going on with math, because Burroughs can be interpreted in so many different ways depending on how you read him.
You mentioned Burroughs regarding masks. I think he would certainly be an artist that could fit in with the anthology. Yeah, we have a couple people writing about Hunter S. Thompson is another one. Which, again, so we're not looking at it literally as like who's wearing, Like, I mean, with Bowie, for a while, he was actually literally playing with masks and characters in a sort of kind of overt way. But it's more like the question of how does an artist reconcile their public persona, who they become known as, and their personal life. That can be, a lot of people have not been able to make that transition. Part of the premise that I'm going with in my piece for the book is, Bowie figured out how to do that, but he almost died in the 70s before he really figured out how to navigate, those altars and kind of put them back in their box.
Well, it's almost again, like the character they played over at times, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but when you're basing that character on parts of yourself or parts of your psyche, it's like you can't actually just put it in the box. It's kind of it's easier if you're an actor and you're like playing a homicidal maniac or something. You can say, that's not me, I'm playing a character. But when you're playing a character that's kind of been constructed out of yourself, it becomes, especially if you're taking lots of drugs at the time and other things that are sort of blurring your boundaries with those things, it becomes difficult. There's that Joaquin Phoenix film, I'm Still Here. Have any of you seen that?
No, I haven't seen it.
I have not.
It's it's entertaining, but it also plays with the sort of like idea of him, in that movie he's supposedly playing himself, but then like it's a fictional movie, so it's kind of reversing it. It's worth watching in that context. It's one of the ones I'm thinking about rewatching and sort of mentioning in my piece for it. It's worth it.
Did you write about Terence McKenna in your book?
Not too much. I think I might have quoted him at one point. I read him a lot back in like early 2000s, sort of more in that Discordian, Illuminati trip, literally trip. So I haven't been as into Terence McKenna lately. I think there's ideas that a lot of these thinkers have ideas that are worth engaging with. That's part of what keeps me going, honestly, is just simply curiosity. And it's like there's always more stuff out there to check out. There's no real reason to do it, but we get all this time, so why not?
As far as your visual work goes, your visual art, which artist had the biggest influence on you?
I don't know if it's stylistically or not, but Dave Mack is the first artist that comes to mind, partially because on several occasions, he sort of goaded me to keep going. He's become pretty well known at this point. He did like the title sequence for Winter Soldier and whatnot, and sort of larger Marvel things. But he did a bunch of Daredevil issues. He's got his own series, Kabuki, and a really distinct style. I think he's worked with Brian Michael Bendis a couple times. I met him, interviewed him a few times, different conventions when I was doing cons more often. And apparently, when he started out, he wanted to write, and he couldn't find an artist to stick with it, you know. And eventually, he wound up sort of teaching himself and doing it, and discovered he's quite good at it, amazingly good at it these days. So whenever I was like, "I'm writing this graphic novel, you know, I need to find an artist," artists keep flaking out on me. It's like, do it yourself.
Oh, so you were a writer before you were a visual artist?
Well, I was a writer before I started working in graphic novels. I mean, I did some like album covers and designs way back, but I hadn't thought of kind of bringing those things together. And I mean, you know, illustrated novels, let alone comics, are very time consuming work.
And as far as your music goes, you said earlier that you came out of the industrial scene of the 90s.
Yeah, industrial metal, little proggy. One band I was in, I mean, we opened for Front 242 back in 2004 or 5. And then we were talking about going on tour, and then we promptly broke up instead, as oftentimes happens. But I co-ran a bunch of recording studios for a number of years. We had a studio in upstate New York, probably the largest one. It's like 13,000 square feet. It was huge. The heating bill wound up being a bit much, but yeah, so I got involved in most of that stuff, and you know, eventually it became more and more studio albums and fewer bands that were playing out. And I've kind of, I don't know, since about 2011, I think it was the last album I've been on. Since then, it's mostly been just focusing on writing and visual art.
What was the one Hood Engine your last Hoodoo was Engine. Your last album?
Yeah. Yeah, Hoodoo Engine's Murder the World, I think, was the last one. That was a fun album to work on. We worked on it for like 2 years. I was living with a couple people in this like basement apartment where we had like these crazy parties and did all sorts of, we were all artists and musicians. And so we were all, you know, working on a bunch of projects with each other and people coming over. And one of the albums that came out of that period of time was Murder the World. And I haven't worked on a full album since then.
Yeah, At the beginning, we were talking about you're working with Joseph Matheny.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure a lot of listeners will be familiar with him, but Joseph actually did a lot of work creating the whole phenomenon of alternate reality games.
Yes.
And I feel like, in a way, that's a precursor to a lot of the things you get at in narrative machines. So I was wondering if you could like tie in this sort of background of alternate reality games and how it relates to some of the current events we're seeing now and the sort of reality TV show era.
Boy, that is a good chunk of narrative machines, but that's hard to sum up, right? Well, I can talk a little bit about working with Joe. So alternate reality games essentially are like creating, you know, a fictional reality people can interact with to a certain, you know, the idea was also of immersive storytelling. It didn't start out, I mean, it's, some of it was online, you know, even back in the late 80s and 90s, but a lot of it was also like, you know, people would have, they'd have phone numbers, you have people playing characters, you'd have, you know, flyers or, you know, notes that are left places, clues, you know. I mean, a lot of them became sort of scavenger, like elaborate scavenger hunts, but some of them were more narrative based. Basically, you had some games developing that became more and more like puzzle games, and some games developing that were more and more sort of story oriented. You know, it's that Michael Douglas movie, The Game, which sort of makes it seem really nefarious, which I guess it could be, but usually wasn't.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting movie where he doesn't, I think his brother gives him that gift, and mm-hmm. He doesn't find out it's a game till the very end.
Yeah, he doesn't realize he's like this whole like elaborate like spy drama that he's has taken over his life is actually, you know, this sort of well-funded game that's being run, you know, which is kind of, you know, ARGs didn't usually go that far, but, although, I mean, this is kind of what's bringing it into, Joe was talking about, like,
It's interesting, as I think that that film actually came out before reality TV culture.
Yeah. You know, that's sense of people not being able to tell the difference between themselves and the characters in the stories. This sort of idea of, you know, playing with people's perception of reality through media, I wouldn't say one example I talk about in the book is, you know, Russian media. Surkov, who's someone who worked with Putin for a while, talks about this pretty overtly, you know, creating kind of false narratives and also just confusing people with a false narrative. So you don't necessarily need to convince people of what the truth is. You just have to make people more and more skeptical that there is such a thing to be found. And a lot of these sort of the techniques that were used in alternate reality games, you see, you know, reoccurring, people creating fake personas online, you know, and some of them creating like a big footprint. So that persona seems to be a real person. They've been around for a while. And then, you know, things happen, whether it's YouTube videos or whatever that seem to document a real event, you know, but it isn't. And if you have a state budget behind something like that, yeah, you can create pretty much, you know, whatever perception you want. Of course, people are going to question it. Some people might find, you know, whatever, but then you have basically the equivalent of conspiracy theories, you know, within that, you know, is this a real story or is this not a real story? So I wouldn't say, though, that, like, you know, Putin was inspired by, or Surkov was inspired by Joseph Matheny or whatever. It's, you know, it's just sort of like almost an eventual realization that would occur when we're immersed in media is that it can be used, you know, in these ways.
Back to the kind of original concept of the simulation, it's sort of media has become like a focal point of our day-to-day lives. And there is a different, it really does impact your psychology, because if you spend a lot of time on the internet and your TV, and then you may, if you take a break from that, say you go on a trip. When I like to travel, I usually like, so, I mean, some people are still always connected. But if you take a break from all that, Facebook, for, say, even a couple days, it does just kind of refresh your mind, and it really does rewire your psychology.
Yeah, it does. There's an interesting sense I find of feeling like you've disappeared from the village. I talk about this in Narrative Machines a bit, where it's like connectivity through social media has become such a kind of mainstay in our lives in a lot of ways for a lot of us, that when you unplug yourself for a period of time, it does feel like you're like, you know, you're re-entering something, but you've also like, you're kind of shut out, you know, like, what am I missing out on? You know, like you, kind of the umbilicus has almost been severed. It's a very kind of strange thing, especially, I know, you know, I think a lot of us more and more are sort of isolated in our day-to-day lives in various ways. And we're sort of cocooned in media of various kinds. You know, I mean, God knows, I know, you know, I'll be like online at the same time as listening to an audiobook, and then I'm watching something, and then I'm, you know, taking in something in another form or whatever, but it's ever present.
Are you a fan of David Lynch, and what do you think about mm-hmm. his films like Mulholland Drive, where he plays with the theme of like what is real and what's not?
I like David Lynch a lot. I don't get a whole lot of use out of, there's some filmmakers who, like, I feel like you can really kind of dig into analyzing their films and get a lot out of that. With his films, I almost feel like, I mean, you can kind of see whatever you want in a lot of, in some of them, but it's like almost more about the experience. His sort of surrealism is very, you know, kind of what you see is what you get. I like watching his work, but it's almost like I don't have a lot to say about it in a way. And I've always found it kind of strange, honestly.
Are you saying, in a sense, it's like a performance art piece?
No, I'm just saying that it's like, I don't think he's, like, I don't think he has, like, necessarily has a message that he's trying to get through beyond what the thing is, you know? I mean, and of course, he some interviews with him, he gets kind of a little pointed about this, you know, where he's kind of like, what's the ultimate point you have here? And he's like, I don't have one, you know, pretty bluntly. You know, which, but at the same time, some people dismiss him for that reason and say, you know, oh, then this is just, you know, nonsense. It's like, no, it's, I mean, in a way, people dismiss also stories that become dreams or stories that involve dreams. And like kind of in a way, all of his films are dreams. But I don't see that as a dismissal. I think dreams are pretty, can be anyways, pretty potent any more than our waking consciousness, certainly.
Oh, I was just going to add in, I think David is David Lynch is a much more, his films are meant to be intuited rather than intellectualized in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying, yeah.
He did this whole documentary on surrealist film, and he comes from that kind of background. It kind of mm-hmm. goes back to his old thing of Dolly's sleep experiment, where supposedly, I don't mean, who knows if it's true or not, but supposedly Dolly would put this spoon on his eye so he would paint from his dreams.
This was more, my first novel was called Join My Cult when I got published by New Falcon. And a lot of that was written through like various sort of kind of quasi-surrealist experiments of like, you know, whether it would be, you know, automatic writing or, you know, writing on sleeping pills or, you know, like all that sort of nonsense. I mean, it's amazing I got it published, right? Or that might have been one of my better selling books. But, you know, so yeah, it was fun. It was fun playing with that stuff. I kind of grew, I don't want to say grew out of it, like, oh, I'm past that and I'm, you know, whatever, but it just, I became more interested in sort of trying to construct a narrative more intentionally, you know, rather than being sort of led along in that way. But
we are at the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, Jamie, is there anything else you'd like to add about narrative machines?
Well, I mean, obviously I would love people to check it out. It's been really good talking to the three of you.
Curcio, thank you for being on. It's been an excellent show. And also thanks, Sam Kevorkian and J.J. Michaels.
You're welcome.
Yep, no problem.
Take care, guys.